Welcome to Rex Factor!
This time, the Battle of the Saxons, live!
With your hosts, Graham Duke and Ali Hood.
Hello!
Hello!
And welcome to the penultimate of our live shows from 2018 in November when we were up in Manchester.
I enjoyed this one.
It's great fun. This was the Battle of the Saxons. Alfred the Great versus his grandson Athelstan.
Worked really well, this one, I thought.
Yeah, this was, and funnily, this was the one that we got was last in the ones that we actually chose to do.
Yeah.
We worried that maybe if you weren't a Rex fan and coming, it might be a little bit too
esoteric or something.
Yeah, you wouldn't know them quite as well. Would it be a bit too similar to Saxons? But actually, it was made for a really good one, because it's a good debating point. The two great Saxon kings, which is the... greatest.
Yeah, because I had a particular axe to grind here with Alfred the Sufficient. Mm-hmm. I can't actually recall who won.
Well, I guess you'll have to listen. It was a well-fought contest.
Yeah.
I'll say that much.
And our man made another appearance, I presume?
Your man.
Did he? Dunstan?
Oh, obviously, yeah. Good of you to bring him up.
Thanks. And while we're on the subject, what a lovely bed and breakfast we had.
We really did, yeah.
I mean, actually, there was no breakfast.
No, it was a B&B. Airbnb. Wasn't
Why do they call it Airbnb if there's no second B?
That's true.
It's Air B.
Air B.
That would have worked just as well.
Air B, B-Y-O-B.
B? Air bed and bring your own booze.
Yes.
All right, so if anyone from the Airbnb is listening, you have that one free.
Yes, so this is a great one. This is at Gulliver's in Manchester. We're up on stage.
Yep.
As we were at Leeds, but this felt like the most sort of...
Stagey stage. Yeah. Oh, London was pretty good, but it wasn't quite as high, was it? Mm.
Yeah. And I was struggling with my hip at this one, so actually getting up on and off the stage wasn't
Well, I thought you were going to have trouble in Leeds as well.
Actually, Leeds, you had to jump off pretty much. So that was
I thought I was going to have to sort of push you, help you up.
Put me on. I think Becca had helped me off, actually.
But you were right by the end. It was quite difficult for you, because you...
It was sitting still for 2 hours, kind of, was...
Every day, and then...
What would actually do it.
But also then, there was a good... amount of driving every single day. And you're a tennis player basically suffering from the Andy Murray issue.
Well, indeed. Very similar.
Are you all right now?
Yeah.
Yeah, good. Don't worry, Rex fans. He's okay to make more podcasts. So,
here is the Battle of the Saxons. Alfred the Great against Athelstan.
Mad for it.
You're in Gulliver's, Manchester. The time is 7 p.m., give or take a number of minutes. You just checked that, didn't you? It's Rex Factor, live, with your hosts, Graham Duke and Ali Hood.
Hello.
Just get this, that's better.
Sorry, that took us quite a while, didn't it, actually, to get to the, to the front.
Longer than expected. And also, you've got a dodgy hip.
Yes, so I'm slightly limping.
Oh, dear. Should have checked this beforehand, sorry. There we are. Right, no, that's not going to do. Hang on, try this again.
Yes, this is our fifth cover, Graham. This is our fifth one, so as you can see, we're a pretty slick unit now that we know
there
exactly
we go.
What
there
we're
we
doing.
Go. Perfect.
You're a little...
Oh, I clash.
Clash a bit.
Yeah. Okay, cover your eyes. It's not that kind of show. Okay. Oh, that's no good. Okay, never mind. This is fine. These are available. Not a giant advert, though, you know, these are available.
Previously, Ali's done that as a kind of reveal for everybody, but unfortunately, I'd already realised I clashed and changed, so...
Yeah,
you just looked...
So who are we today? What's going on?
Well, so if you've never listened to us before, we are Rex Factor. I'm Graham and this is Ali.
Hello.
And what we do in our podcast is we review all the monarchs of initially England and then Scotland. We go through their life and reign and then we review them by a number of different factors. And at the end, we decide which one of them has a certain something that we call the Rex Factor.
But not today.
Not today. Today we are doing a battle between two of the monarchs that we have previously covered in our series. And in fact, we're doing two of the very first monarchs that we ever reviewed, Alfred the Great and Æthelstan.
Right.
And Ali, what are we calling this?
Battle of the Saxons.
Battle of the Saxons.
Brilliant.
Indeed.
Now, this is a bit unusual for us because usually it's just me and Graham in his room, bedroom, and just a computer. And we can't really... We have things to do. Yeah, that's going to get used a lot today, I think.
That's our scandal bell.
This is the scandal bell, in fact. Yeah. But we're not going to decide tonight. It's up to you guys. So that's why you have these cards in front of you. You might have worked out the system.
Well, it's quite a complicated system, but we'll explain it at the end. Mm-hmm. It all went very wrong when we did the Battle of the Favourites, and my favourite, Henry VIII, and Ali's favourite, Edward I. And I think people got really about the colour system, because otherwise,
I'll take an administration error. I'm happy with the win either way. But that was pretty resounding, spoiler alert.
Well, indeed, yes. So, as I said, tonight we're going to be doing Alfred the Great and Æthelstan. The reason we wanted to do this is that Alfred is the only monarch in English history known as the Great. But for many people who've listened to the podcast, they might argue that actually Æthelstan should be considered at least as great, if not greater than Alfred, and he maybe deserves more of the credit for creating the nation of England. So what we're going to ask you tonight is which one of these two really deserves to be known as the great, Alfred or Æthelstan?
And then once you've decided, we're going to do some Q&A, so you can ask us anything that you want. But if you're embarrassed to ask us in public, please do hang around. We're selling t-shirts, but we're going to be down in the bar afterwards and come and say hello, because it's really nice to finally meet some Rex Factor fans rather than just talking at your computer and you.
Well, it's nice to talk to.
Well, it's lovely to talk to you always, Graham, but you know, it's not these guys are interesting. I've known you for years.
Well, let's hear some more from me then, shall we?
Good.
Perfect timing. A quick overview of the two monarchs we're going to be doing today. Alfred the Great was born in the year 849 and became king in 871 when he was 22 years old, which Ali recently decided is the optimum age.
A sweet spot.
The monarchs.
No, I think we thought it was 21. I don't know why, but it was sort of like you've got enough wherewithal to not have a minority. And then it sets you up for a great big longevity.
Indeed. We don't know exactly what he looked like. There are no contemporary portraits or photographs, obviously, of Alfred the Great. His biographer, a chap called Asser, describes him as being more comely in appearance than his brothers and more pleasing in manner, speech and behaviour. Which would be more illuminating if we knew what his brothers looked or sounded like.
Yeah, some fair reference. And this is the problem I have with the Saxons. That's the sort of thing that they're really keen on. Mm. You know, just being really nice and really good looking rather than, you know, give us some scandal. Come on.
You want that scandal, don't you?
Yeah.
Well, he comes across in Asser as being quite sensitive and highly strong and a rather pious man. Which isn't quite up your
Straza.
Up your street. But he was still very determined, and he wouldn't have survived if he was a weak king. So he was a warrior king.
Yeah.
But he also possibly suffered some health issues, perhaps Crohn's disease or some kind of kidney complaint. Unusually for the time, Alfred is also a philosopher king. He actually translates great works of Latin into English, and he does his own notes and introductions. So we actually get a sense of what he thought about kinging, about justice, about all of this sort of thing. So we do get a bit of an insight into his personality.
Which is pretty rare at this time, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so maybe that's why he's the great.
Well, maybe. Let's look at Æthelstan. He was born in the year 893, and he is the grandson of Alfred the Great. He became king in the year 924 when he was 32 years old, which,
too old.
Despite being younger than we now are, you've decided is basically...
Yeah, that's true. Oh, God. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm not trying to be king. These guys should have thought of that.
If it was handed to you now, you'd say, nope, sorry, I'm past it.
Yeah,
but
I probably would.
In terms of his appearance, he's described by William of Malmesbury, which is based on looking at his 150-year-old corpse, as having had fair hair intertwined with gold and being tall and handsome. And I suppose if you look handsome after 150 years of dying...
saying
then,
something, isn't it? Yeah, yeah.
You imagine.
Yeah, wow.
Again, we don't have a surviving biography of Æthelstan, unfortunately, and he wasn't featured much in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, but he seems to have had quite an imperial mindset in military affairs and yet also presides over a very cultured court. So perhaps similar to Alfred, we've got the battliness, but we've also got a lot of culture going on as well.
Mm-hmm.
So let's look at their lives and reigns in more detail. Ali, do you remember what comes
well,
next?
Well, this time we're sitting closer so I can see it. It is biography. And I apologise about the hands. I've been doing it for a long time now, and for some reason I can't do it without doing the hands. It gets annoying.
So a bit of backgroundy stuff for Alfred the Great to understand the context when he came to the throne. At this point, England doesn't actually yet exist as a country. We've got a smaller series of kingdoms like Wessex, which is where Alfred's from, Mercia in the Midlands, Northumbria up north. And from the 860 up here, I suppose.
We are, yeah, I was going to say, we are here, just, you know.
So be careful what we say. Let's not repeat the mistake we made in Leeds last night.
Oh, God.
And by we, I obviously mean Ali.
Yeah. Manchester were great. It was really awkward.
From the 860s, England sees a series of major Viking raids and then settlements, and all the kingdoms in England start to fall to the Vikings, and Wessex is pretty much the last one that's left still standing. Wessex is sort of the south and southwest of England. Now, Alfred, as a young boy, goes to Rome as a child, which is a very major influence, but it's unlikely that he would ever have become king, because he's actually the youngest of five brothers.
It's a violent time, though. Did they all get it in war?
They're all in war, or just general Saxons not living very long.
Oh, right, yeah.
Cause of death. But none of them, apart from his last brother, produce any children. And because his children are very young, Alfred ends up taking the throne.
Okay, so but he's born with rivals then. Are there people that want his nephews as
king? He does have nephews, but they will be a trouble for his son rather than himself. Fine. He's got to deal, though, with the Vikings. He becomes king in the year 871, suffered an early defeat to the Vikings, but makes a peace with them. But then 7 years later, in 878, on Twelfth Night, the Vikings, led by a chap called Guthrum, surprise him at Chippenham. He's forced to flee from court and, with a few supporters, takes refuge in the marshes of Athelney in Somerset. So at this point, Alfred, Wessex, England, if you like, is really just now based hiding in a swamp, hoping the Vikings don't find them.
Is that modern-day Glastonbury, the levels?
Yeah, it's that sort of area in Somerset.
Right, so when you say that, you imply that there's an idea of England. It's the Saxon nation is reduced to that level.
Well, I suppose it's because everywhere else that was Saxon really is being conquered by the Vikings.
Right.
So this is the last bit that's still Saxon and independent.
Doesn't look good.
It's not looking good.
No.
This is where we get a legend of Alfred burning the cakes. He was said to have been sheltering in the house of a cowherd, asked by the wife to keep an eye on the cakes. And his mind was so much focused on all of the military troubles going on that he took his eye off the cakes and they burned.
What do we learn from that?
Well, that you can't trust Alfred with a cake.
Well, yeah. Brilliant. Okay.
It's a metaphor for the fact that he took his eye off the kingdom. Didn't shore up its defences when he had a chance, and as a result, it's
all gone to pot. Cake defences? I don't get this. I'd much rather he was thinking about the battles than the cakes. I think that's a good way to be.
She should have given him a bit of a break.
Yeah.
He was having a hard time.
Don't tell anyone about it, certainly.
Yeah. However, he does have a plan. He is able to establish a secret network with some of his supporters across the country, and gradually they come together and they agree a meeting point, and they're going to have one last try to get back and attack the Vikings. And this ends up being the Battle of Edington. Alfred leads really an all-or-nothing battle for the Saxons and is victorious. The Vikings are defeated.
But that's not the end of them, is it?
Oh, it's certainly not the end of the Vikings generally, but it does mean that Alfred has got his kingdom back and he is now able to rebuild. He actually is as we said, he's a pious man. So rather than killing Guthrum, the Viking leader, he has him baptised.
That's narrow, isn't it?
Well,
does he go along?
He'd have just had his head straight off.
Yeah, yeah. Well, definitely. Does he come back to give him problems?
Well, no, not actually. He doesn't do much. What he does as well is he gives him land in East Anglia. So he gives him a stake in Alfred's kingdom.
Right.
So actually, Guthrum thinks there's something in this for him. So that if he plays ball, he's got some territory, he's got some land. You don't need to be raiding if you've got that.
Okay, so he's Saxon now.
He's a little bit Saxon, and in 886 they agree a split of the kingdom. So we have established a thing called the Dane Law. So the Danes take the east and northeast of England, and then everything else south of that and west of that is England.
Watling Street. I was driving down that the other day. Had a car crash. It was great. But that was one of the things that went through my mind as the trailer zoomed past me. Oh, this is Watling Street.
Yes, it wasn't your life flashing by, just a...
the one time I remembered anything from Rex Factor. I just need...
But Alfred doesn't just sort out Guthrum and think, well, that's the problem sorted. He does have more plans going on. And one of these is setting up things called burhs. So these are essentially sort of fortified market towns. So the idea is that they are going to be within 20 miles of each other, so that if the Vikings attack, you've got a base to defend, and then you'll be able to reinforce during the same day, and the Vikings will have to go home.
Hmm. Well, that's pretty clever.
Also reorganises the army so that you can always have half the people working in the fields, half the people actually in service, so that you've always got food and soldiers.
That's very clever.
Mm. Mm. So there's a Viking invasion in the 890s in Alfred's reign, but they're unable to get a firm footing in the country because this system of burhs and the reorganised army is actually now very effective in seeing them off.
Brilliant.
But it's not just military affairs that Alfred is concerned about. He also thinks that we need to get the country back on its feet, and he focuses on education. He was actually illiterate until he was a teenager, but he was always fascinated with books and learning. So he believed that with learning, we can improve ourselves. And so he headhunts scholars from all over Europe and Britain, translates all these great Latin works. He even has to learn Latin himself so that he can translate them into English for everybody else.
Mm.
And he leaves behind this legacy of learning that was almost taken away by all of these Viking invasions.
So hang on, he was employing monks to do it, but he was also doing it himself?
He was also doing it himself.
Wow. Mm. I mean, do we want that from a ruler? Shouldn't he have been doing other stuff? Or is this a hobby?
Bigger things to focus on. Yeah, I guess it's a hobby.
Right. Mm, yeah, pretty good.
So when he dies in the year 899 at the age of 50, England is not yet finalised as we see it today. The borders aren't complete. As we said, we've still got that Danelaw territory on the east and northeast. But nevertheless, Alfred has set a vision and a foundation of what could become England.
Mm. That's pretty punchy. Hmm. I liked it at the time when we did it first, didn't I?
Yes, you always used to like Alfred, and then for some reason you decided that it was all very muddy. And
well, it's undoubtedly muddy. It would have been awful. So miserable. Look, I've built you a new house out of mud. And, oh, horrible.
I'm just wondering, like, did you go to Glastonbury after we did the Alfred episode and it was one of the rainy years?
Grumpy. No, I have never been. But no, I don't know why. I don't know what caused it. Maybe it was the later episodes on Athelstan that made me think. It was the first one, and I think maybe I hadn't, you know, found a level.
Well, let's see if hearing about Athelstan reignites your sense that Alfred wasn't quite good enough. Mm.
We'd normally cut all this.
It's the same. It's a similar name, and I keep trying to say Alfred. Ali usually says Arthur when he means Alfred. So I'm now saying Athelstan. So Athelstan was actually invested by his grandfather Alfred as a young boy. So there was a sense that Alfred had a vision of Athelstan as the future king that would carry on his work. So he's given a cloak, a belt and a sword.
Lucky boy.
Lucky boy indeed.
Yeah.
Athelstan's father continues building all of these burhs, and he expands territories now into East Anglia, Essex and later Mercia. So we can see that from Alfred's time, we've now expanded further north. So England is starting to become more of a reality by the time that Athelstan becomes king. Athelstan is actually brought up by his aunt, Ethelfled, who becomes Lady of the Mercians. So she's actually a warrior queen ruling in the Midlands, and it's her and Athelstan's father who are the key alliance in building on what Alfred had started.
Cool. Are we going to do her in the next series?
We are going to do her in the next series. Yeah, cool. Looking forward to doing her. So when Athelstan's father, Edward the Elder, dies, it's a little bit awkward in terms of the succession because his father had remarried and has sons by his second marriage, and they seem to be seen as the people who are actually going to succeed him in Wessex.
Mm.
Fortunately, the person who does become king in Wessex dies just a few weeks later.
Hooray.
And Athelstan is able to establish himself as king instead. But it's only the year after his father died, 925, that Athelstan is crowned. So perhaps there are lingering divisions within.
Because there's not Wessex. A sense of England that you could still be king of one of these little kingdoms of Wessex, and it would all.
Yeah, and Athelstan was the eldest son, but perhaps the second marriage was seen as being more prestigious, so the new children were seen as being up the hierarchy.
Right, okay.
Either way, Athelstan has managed to become king himself, so it's not a problem. Now, in York, we have a very powerful Norse ruler called Sitric. So he owns Northumbria and also Dublin. So we've got this sort of Viking axis of Dublin, Northumbria, and then obviously off to Viking land.
Mm. Well, that was something that we got from that special episode on Vikings that perhaps I didn't appreciate when we were doing the Saxons first time round, that it wasn't just mainland England, us versus them, but they were totally surrounded in Ireland and in Viking lands and in England and parts of mainland Europe. So it really was backs against the wall job.
So at this point, it's not clear that England is inevitably going to become the country that it is now. It was just as possible that you could have England that's much smaller, Scotland that's much smaller, and then this very powerful bit in the middle, which is ruled by Vikings. So actually at the start, Athelstan makes a deal with this chap Sitric, marries his sister to him to make some kind of peace treaty.
I'm surprised. I thought he would have insisted that they were baptised as well, rather than marrying his sister to someone who wasn't Christian.
Well, I guess he was a powerful enough ruler that Athelstan couldn't just get rid of him or enforce terms on him.
Okay.
Thankfully, though, in 927, Sitric dies. And as such, Athelstan is able to show what he's really made of. And he zooms straight into York, invades, captures the city, and receives the submission of the Northumbrians. And this is the first time that we've actually got the Northumbrians showing that they are paying homage to the southern Wessex rulers.
Again. Careful. But that's great. That's, you know, for the creation of England.
Well, yeah, exactly. So this is the first time that we've actually got all of these parts of England now being part of England and ruled definitively by the same person. However, he's not finished just with York. He then calls a meeting of all the Welsh, Cumbrian and Scottish rulers. They all have to come to Penrith and pay him homage and accept that he is their overlord and they're not going to make any more deals with those pesky Vikings.
Welsh kings as well?
Welsh king, Scottish king, and the rule of Cumbria.
So, now, I've got a little game that I'm playing with Graham on this tour where I try and squeeze as much Edward I in as possible.
That's first reference tonight.
So, does that mean that there was some sort of precedent for Edward when he claimed to be king of Wales? And, the, you know, there was some sense of legality when he went... It wasn't necessarily conquering, he was just getting his territory back when he went through.
Well, I mean, without going too much into Edward I, because we have done him already, to be honest.
Not enough.
Edward doesn't really say that he's king of Wales, he just says that they owe him homage. So when they don't pay homage, he says, well, no, you definitely owe me money.
But is this the first time that those Welsh kings have...
I think Alfred had got a certain amount of it as well, and Ethelfled, but Athelstan is taking it further than anybody else by actually having them come to him in England and in a very public ceremony acknowledging him as their superior.
Right, okay.
And apparently not all of the Welsh kings actually finish off with this, so on his way back from Penrith, he pops off to Wales to deal with a rebellion there, and then pops down to Cornwall to also deal with a rebellion there.
All right, just mopping up all the details.
Yeah, so you've gone to York, Penrith, Wales, Cornwall.
That's pretty similar to our tour.
And he does this all in a space of a year. So from start of 927, when we've not really yet got England fully established, suddenly he's just zoomed all over the place and there it is.
Sorted it out. Brilliant.
Now, it doesn't all go according to plan after this, because the King of Scots, a chap called Constantine II, seems to have rebelled against Athelstan, but he made a bit of a mistake in doing this, because Athelstan raises a huge army, including actually the Welsh princes, so they're not just paying Athelstan homage, they actually have to fight in his armies as well. And he invades Scotland, so he goes north with an army, he also sends a navy all the way round to Caithness, right at the top, and Constantine has to submit once again, and then goes south with Athelstan. And so we've got Constantine, the Cumbrians and the Welsh following Athelstan just all around in his court, witnessing charters.
Wow.
And really very clearly being inferior to Athelstan.
And Constantine was a Rex Factor winner?
He did in the Scottish series, so he was a very effective king, but he's nevertheless having to follow Athelstan around. And Athelstan is now not only styling himself King of England, he's actually starting to style himself as the Emperor of Britain.
Oh, wow.
So it's not even just that he's dominant over these countries, he's now asserting that he effectively is the ruler of the whole island.
And we don't see that again for, well, hang on, let me do some maths, 700 years?
Yeah, it's really not until the union of the crowns with James VI.
Wow.
That we have that again, so it's probably the most powerful
service. Oh, hang on, what about Edgar?
Well, he's not, it's similar.
Similar, okay, fine.
But he says he's probably the most powerful person in the country since the Romans, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's all very impressive. And as you said at the start, he's also a cultured man as well as a military man. So the royal court is much larger than his predecessors, much larger than for Alfred, which is perhaps one of the things you picked up on. So rather than these mud huts and everyone having a bit of a hard time, Athelstan will have pageantry. We've got court poets and people coming from all across Europe to be at Athelstan's court because he's a highly respected ruler now. He continues his grandfather's works with lots of forward-thinking legal reforms and religious patronage. He's got lots and lots of half-sisters thanks to his father's various marriages. So they all get married to royal families on the continent. And he also fosters sons of other European rulers because he's seen being a very illustrious ruler, and that's where you want to be. You want to be at Athelstan's court.
Wow, that's really helpful, isn't it? So he's got all these alliances going on, so it's everything is getting properly settled. We're not going to go back to any of this Watling Street business.
Well, except that the other rulers in Britain aren't so happy about having to submit to him and follow him around all the time.
Okay,
so consequently, Constantine. I'll say that one quickly. Forms an alliance of Scots, Cumbrians, and the Irish Vikings. They all band together to try and topple Athelstan one last time.
Oh dear. Vikings as well?
Vikings, Scots, Cumbrians are all together.
Oh, right, okay.
Doesn't look good. We have an epic battle of Brunanburh in 937. This is potentially going to decide the future of Britain, and it is a victory for Athelstan. He defeats his enemies.
Yeah, that's brilliant. That's so that now there's no question. Everyone's defeated. Everyone initially gave their homage, and now actually he's beaten them in battle as well. Job done.
Job done. And as such, with nothing else to do, a couple of years later, Athelstan dies. The year 939, he was only 46 at the time, but very much at the height of his powers. And he's buried in Malmesbury rather than Winchester in Wessex, which suggests he's maybe still not quite a fully Wessex man.
Well, hang on. He's buried in Malmesbury in...
Malmesbury, which isn't in the old kingdom of Wessex.
Oh, right. Okay.
So there's maybe still a little bit of a lingering thing going on there. But nevertheless, he has died. He's defeated his enemies and we have England fully formed.
That's brilliant. It's just like the podcast.
We'll leave those in. So what are you thinking at this point? So you've heard both of their life stories.
I'm back with Athelstan. Definitely. That's brilliant. I mean, okay, the other fella... Alfred. he set him up, but Athelstan knocked it out of the park.
Well, that's the interesting thing with these. It's the continuity. It's the continuation of the same story.
Yeah.
So obviously you can't get to Athelstan without all of the stuff that Alfred does.
Yeah.
So it's whether you pay more to Alfred building those foundations, saving the country, or if you think that actually the raw power and majesty of Athelstan trumps
Have we had this before? I'm just thinking of Henry VII, Henry VIII, but Henry VIII we gave it to for reasons that he's just got this star quality, not that he was so much better.
One of the problems for Athelstan, perhaps, in history has been that Alfred has his Asa, which is a Welsh monk, rather than anything slightly ruder. So we've got Alfred's biography sent down to us. So essentially, we know that Alfred's great because he tells us that he is. Whereas Athelstan, there may have been a biography, but it's now been lost to history. So perhaps we lose some of his personality and interest about Athelstan. So we've had even more about him, which perhaps once existed.
And a Victorian Renaissance and interest in that period and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, his achievements are so much greater. I mean, they come from was born with a silver spoon and that he had all this potential. I mean,
Alfred probably almost literally gave him a silver spoon.
Yeah, but... He turned it platinum because he then went off and did the whole, conquered the whole country. Whereas Alfred was from a miserable start and achieved a lot. But, founding the borders of modern England is amazing.
Well, let's have a look at them factor by factor to see if that makes it any clearer who really was the great.
Battliness!
You've got these down now.
And I'm reading them.
You are reading them. So this is how good they were in battle. And both of them obviously have some pretty big successes. It starts badly, of course, for Alfred. He had to make an initial peace treaty with the Vikings after losing. And obviously being kicked out into the marshlands wasn't particularly impressive.
Not good.
But he also does a lot of very impressive things. Before he became king, there was the Battle of Ashdown, when his brother was apparently still praying in his tent, despite the fact that the Vikings were actually marching at them. So Alfred leads his troops against both of the sets of Viking forces up a hill in the Shield Wall, and was said to have fought like a wild boar until his brother joined and they were able to enjoy a rare victory.
Well, I'm getting a lot of my research about Alfred from the recent BBC adaptation of Bernard Cornwell.
Yeah, The Last Kingdom.
The Last Kingdom, that's the one. And I thought Alfred did that at one point, where he was just praying all the time and not on the ball.
He did pray all the time, but he does also fight.
Okay, yeah, swings and roundabouts.
Yeah. The biggie, though, for Alfred is the Battle of Edington in 878. This is when he'd been reduced just to hiding in the swamps. That's the entirety, really, the English world at this stage is just Alfred in the marshland, hiding about, trying not to get picked off by Vikings.
Yeah, yeah.
But he emerges. We have a very dramatic charge. Apparently, it was at dawn, and they charged downhill into the Vikings. It's a long, hard battle through the day. Another one of those shield walls, which, if you've not seen something like The Last Kingdom, they're all right together, shields tightly packed, pushing against each other. And then just swords,
yeah,
poking
like a
through.
Rugby scrum with daggers.
Yeah, it's horrible. A really brutal, brutal way of fighting. But Alfred wins against the Vikings. And in the Scottish series, whenever anybody took the Vikings on, you always used to say that was a really stupid thing to do.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you'd lose.
Yeah, I thought that was true in the English series as well, but we started with victories.
But you shouldn't take it for granted, because this is an all-or-nothing victory. You could argue that if Alfred has lost this battle, he would have almost certainly been killed. England would... Oof.
That's a first.
Except when you did it earlier.
Yes. First in the last 10 minutes. Yeah. Right. Carry on.
If Alfred had lost this battle and Alfred had been killed, there would never have been an England. The English-speaking world would never have existed. The country that comes after that never happens.
It would have been like another Scandinavian nation.
Yeah.
And sort of North... What is it? Like North Sea Empire with... Canute.
Yeah.
Wow.
So if you're talking big battles in English history, it probably doesn't get actually much better than this, really, if he'd lost.
Well, how would that compare to 1066?
Like, well, we lost that one.
Yeah.
I suppose by that point, though, there was still an England. So even though the rulers took over and were all French, you still actually had the English people carrying on as they were, but that was because an England had already been set up. Whereas for Alfred, it wasn't really there.
Mm. Yeah. Well, Battle of Britain then.
Okay. I mean, but a lot later now.
Yeah. I don't know why I'm trying to disprove this. I agree. Carry
Important
on.
Battle.
Yeah.
He also does a bit of work in setting up a navy. He recognises that the Viking strength is their ability to come very far inland with their ships. So he designs and builds a small navy.
Yeah, I should love that.
You should love that. And he had about 100 ships and some success, but perhaps I think it was because he also has quite a few defeats. So he's got ships, but it's not quite as effective as you might like. So the Victorians claim that Alfred starts the Royal Navy, but actually it's just he builds some ships and some he wins, some he loses.
Okay.
But it's forward thinking.
Yeah, massive great battle. Yeah, that's his crowning achievement.
Pretty well, good. And the Burrs. So we've got the battle as an offensive victory, but the Burrs are how he is then able to see off the Vikings. So as I said, 20 miles apart, so that meant it's always a day's ride to each new reinforcement. So the Vikings, who like to go in quickly, stabby, 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 and take all the food home, but now they get caught by defences, and then all these other Saxons turn up and fight them off.
So these are like the birth of castles then?
In a way, yes, which is something that Ali will like.
Okay,
so
that's
yes,
a thinker.
Alfred invented castles, kind of.
Yeah, that's put everything on its head.
But it's very clever, and to go to 1940, as you did just earlier, one of Alfred's designs at Wareham, the ramparts were actually used as anti-tank defences in the war.
Oh, that's cool.
So something that Alfred built in the 870s or 80s was still being utilised for defence of the country.
Wow.
1,000 years later.
Wow, wow, wow. Previously, I thought the longest defence was Dover, the way that was still used in the Second World War, but that's fantastic. Just because they were massive earth ramparts.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, okay, you're persuading me. What about Athelstan?
Well, I mean, the one thing I'll give you for Alfred is the fact that it isn't yet England. So Alfred was said to have been king over the whole English people, except for that part which was under Danish rule. which,
yeah.
They probably didn't mean that to be quite such a ridiculous caveat as it sounds, but there is a limit to Alfred's dominance. It's not the whole of what we'd now call England. There are still Viking rulers in the country.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but it's ready for his grandson.
Exactly. So for Athelstan, we had that blitzkrieg really in 927 when he rushed in to take York. The York chronicler afterwards said that we were never subject to any of the kings of the South Angles before Athelstan. So it really is a first that Athelstan has done here.
So do they feel like they're being invaded then?
Well, yes. I mean, that's one of the interesting things for the creation of England is that actually for some people in different parts of it, you might not necessarily see it as a positive.
Yeah, we're sort of imagining that there's all these
conquered
English...
by Wessex, really.
Yeah, there's all these English people just waiting to be given a name. And we all, you know, that actually it's Wessex conquering York. And there were lots of them that were happy under Dane law or were Danish. Weird. So... okay, so it's actually not clear cut. This might go either way. This is not going to, it's not like the people of York are thinking, oh, thank God, finally, we're happy now. He might face further rebellion.
Exactly. He then, as he said, went on to Aymond Bridge in Penrith to receive submissions for all these other rulers. So it's the first of several effectively imperial councils that Athelstan likes to hold. And he does put in quite a lot of pageantry as well. So he's very much trumpeting the fact that he is dominant over all these people. It's not just a few kings signing on a dotted line and quietly going back home again. Something that everybody gets to see.
Right, yeah. Bit of propaganda. Inventing PR.
If you will. there was a big rebellion in northwest Wales soon after this. Apparently there were five kings that Athelstan had to go and force to submit to him, which they do. Had to pay a huge tribute, apparently 25,000 oxen and unlimited hawks. So anytime Athelstan needed a hawk, he just sent a pigeon, I suppose, to the Welsh.
Just send a hawk. He's got loads of them. Another one. Yeah, brilliant.
And then, as we said, he effectively styles himself Emperor of Britain. It's not just what we now term England. It's the Welsh, it's the Scots, it's the whole island. That's an extraordinary thing to have achieved from being in a point when he didn't even have the north of England and suddenly he's got all the land that you can see.
Until you reach the sea. He owns everything. That's amazing.
Yeah, exactly. Very impressive. It's not clear to what extent he has to fight battles to do all of this. So to give him a battle in a score, is it because he's great at fighting or is it just that he storms in with lots of troops and they think, well, we'll sign your bit of paper and go along with the ceremony and then you'll go home and we'll just carry on as if nothing ever happened.
Yeah, there's probably a lot of that, but then it all comes to a head again, doesn't it?
It does all come to a head again. Initially, it came to a head in 934 when Constantine of the Scots broke that initial agreement. But as I said, Athelstan goes up to Aberdeen by land. The fleet attack Caithness. Constantine submits. And it's amazingly quick how he does it all. He was in May in Winchester in England, southern England, and then he was back home again in September.
Wow.
So he's got all the way up to Aberdeen, dealt with rebellion, and then come home again.
Goodness, that's like Henry II job.
Yeah, so that's just 4 months
fantastic.
To do all of that.
He's looking pretty good. I mean, it's going to be good without the big battle.
He's also perhaps the first Saxon king to really have some foreign intervention as well. He supports the restoration of a Breton and Frankish royal families, and in 939 he sent an English fleet to Flanders to help an ally there. So that's the first time we have direct foreign intervention.
Wow. Fantastic. Well, is it fantastic? It does set us up for a fall later in history.
A fine legacy of British intervention abroad followed. But it's an interesting what power he had, that Alfred was struggling just to have something that was England.
Yeah.
Athelstan's actually sending the fleet off to help other countries.
Yeah, that's the bit that I think is great, that it shows that it isn't just this funny little backwater of Europe, but actually a really powerful kingdom that can help allies and is involved with the politics of Europe.
You know, it's only like 50 years since Alfred was in the swamps and here he is, Emperor of Britain, sending fleets to Flanders.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
It's an amazing turnaround. The biggie, though, is the Battle of Brunanburh, the alliance of the Scots, the Irish, the Vikings. It's said to have been an epic battle lasting all day, and there are a lot of casualties. Athelstan loses two of his cousins, two earls, and one bishop.
How did he lose a bishop?
I really shouldn't be here.
Yeah, exactly. No. They were going around with their maces and clubs, weren't they?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's probably all the robes. Probably fell over all the robes, didn't they?
Oh yeah, but it's worse for the coalition of his enemies. 5 kings and 7 earls on the opposing side were killed.
It sounds like a game of chess, losing a bishop and a king. But you know, clearly he has lost more of the other pieces.
Mm. And obviously, thousands of people who aren't earls and bishops
who don't get recorded to memory. Yeah.
In the 980s, it was still being referred to as the Great Battle. It's one of the biggest battles really in Anglo-Saxon history. It just gets overshadowed by, obviously, like you mentioned, the Battle of Hastings.
Yeah,
but for a long time this was the definitive conflict.
That's really interesting parallel, isn't it, that they both faced these massive defining moments. Alfred to survive at all, and Athelstan to protect this idea of Britain. Oh, it's really tricky to split those two apart.
Yeah, I mean, for Athelstan, if you're going to criticise him, apparently he took a little bit too long to raise an army, but if you see what happened to the Saxons at Hastings, maybe it was wise to take a bit of time out. But actually, all of the rival leaders survive Athelstan. He's actually the first of them to die, so they all survive the battle. And after he dies, the Vikings effectively did what Athelstan did, rush into York, take it all back. So Athelstan is his successor, then has to spend the next few years kind of recovering all of the territory. So in a way, Athelstan wins the battle. It all seems fine. He dies and then it goes back again. So it's not like Athelstan starts an unending period going up. It does sort of take another little bit of a dip.
But what could he have done differently? That he had the burhs all set up. It's not.
Well, I mean, what you've been complaining about kings and all this live tour, he just shouldn't have died.
Quite right. He shouldn't have died. He should have done a lot more living, and then that would have been absolutely sorted. Who was his successor? His son, or was it one of these weird Scottish systems?
It was his one of his brothers, Edmund, half brother.
Might have been part of the problem.
Mm. In terms of scores, Alfred, we gave 11 out of 20, and Athelstan 17. But I think surely Alfred was undermarked.
Oh, he definitely was, doesn't it? Wasn't he? That was. That was the problem of doing our first episode. We had no idea about levels of actually, you know, what a great battle in a score was. I think that probably reflects it. I think they'd be more equal.
Yeah. I mean, that's to say, they both have an epic, crucial battle and victory to their name. And it's progress. Alfred starts quite small and has to build up. Athelstan is obviously fighting on a grander scale.
But achieves a lot.
So I guess the question is, are you more impressed by Alfred's sort of backs against the walls, last chance saloon, and then setting up? Or is it Athelstan having this huge power and empire and being able to take on this epic
coalition
group against him?
I think normally, you know, I love an underdog, so I should be Alfred. But I think here, I think it's Athelstan for me because it's such an incredible concept that is then set up. Okay, yeah, it does go back again, but that the idea is then placed in the minds of the nation. You know, maybe this is an ideal to keep going back to, and it does, it forms the idea of Britain, of England.
But it's easier in a way for Athelstan, isn't it? Because Alfred's got nothing really. He really is completely up against it, whereas Athelstan inherits all of what Alfred did, all of what Edward the Elder and Ethelfled did. So Athelstan comes to the throne with lots of resources, lots of troops, all these burhs that have been built. So in a way, it's all been set up for him to finish the job, whereas actually Alfred, he's in an appalling position.
Yeah, but he does finish the job. And I sort of think with Alfred that there's occasions later on in Saxon history where, you know, the Saxons are have, you know, backs against the wall against the Vikings, and there's the odd win which gives them breathing space. You know, that it wasn't on the scale of Athelstan's victory, like everyone against him. It was the Vikings and him, another skirmish.
It's not to underestimate the Vikings, though.
Yeah.
And that was, Alfred was against peak Viking, really. That was full-on great summer army, all these, they've been rampaging all over the place.
Yeah, I find it hard to put anything between them. I think they're both really good, but I just think if you were to see Brunanburh, that would be amazing. And the old muddy, swampy battle would be...
The mud's coming back into it.
It would be great in the it's a victory, but it doesn't make quite the Hollywood movie that the Brunenburg battle would.
Despite the Bernard Cornwell series currently showing about Alfred the Great.
Yeah. But this is what Rex Factor is about, isn't it? All the time we're saying, I can't believe they're making another film about, for example, now we'd normally cut that, Robin Hood. And there's all of these people in history that are crying out to have a film made about them. Why isn't there an Athelstan movie? It'd be amazing. Any film producers? No? All right.
Should we move on to the next category?
Yes. Isn't there Scandal?
You weren't quite sure that it was.
There's two S's, yeah.
So we also like to see how much infamy and notoriety the kings can get up to. That's a crucial part of what we like to see in a king. Unfortunately, these two are perhaps not the most scandalous monarchs in English history. A bit too religious and pious.
Yeah, they're not going to school well.
Business. That said, Alfred the Great does seem to have had something of a hang-up of carnal lust.
Oh, good. Right, great.
Seems to have been highly sexed in his youth, and he feared that he would receive a subsequent illness as a punishment from God. So he seems to be a bit obsessed about it, to the extent that you think, well, there must be something there.
Yeah.
Like he would actually pray for a painful disease to inhibit his desires.
What?
Which on the one hand is obviously him wanting not for you to be dinging that bell.
Yeah.
But he must have really wanted that bell to be to pray for it not to happen.
Yeah. Oh, poor chap was very conflicted, wasn't he?
Yeah.
So did he see it through and then just do lots of praying to make up for it? Or?
Well, potentially he may have been pretty much chaste after he had his children with his wife. But also potentially has an illegitimate child. So,
hang on. He has children
with his wife.
With his wife, and then decides that's quite enough.
Yeah,
I've got enough kids in the Saxon age where you really can't have enough kids because it's all so bloody and disease ridden. And he's actually allowed to have sex with his wife under the he's married.
He is, yeah.
So why does he say that's quite enough, thanks?
Well, I guess because he wants God to inhibit his carnal desires. So if he's going to allow them any form of outlet, then that's going to be far too much.
Okay. Okay. Right.
And that's all we've got for Alfred.
Oh, dear Alfred.
You know, you wanted to see him beheading the Vikings, but instead he baptised Guthrum.
Yeah, no good at all. I'm hoping Athelstan has a bit more about him.
Well, Athelstan is perhaps a little bit suspicious when we look at what happens to some of his brothers.
Right.
As we said, initially, when his father died, it was a bit uncertain about the succession, because even though Athelstan was the older son, Edward the Elder's children by his second marriage seemed to have been considered a bit more royal and up the food chain than him. But, very conveniently, Elfwiard, his next brother in the queue, the one that which was recognised in Wessex, dies.
Okay, I'm hovering.
Now, he has another half-brother by that second marriage, a chap called Edwin, who is also favoured in Wessex. And in the year 933, he was put onto a boat without any provisions and which was apparently full of holes.
Oh, come on. That's ridiculous. Why? What explanation did they have for that? Just he was going on a fishing trip or something?
In fairness to Athelstan, it might have been coincidence that the first one died. Edwin was implicated in two plots to have Athelstan blinded.
What is with the blinding in this time?
The Saxons used to they used to like blinding people. It wasn't a general sort of Saturday night
activity. They seemed to.
Activity.
The evidence is there.
The issue for them was that if a king was blind, then they would consider he wasn't able to rule his people and he couldn't lead them in battle. But crucially, you wouldn't actually have killed the king.
He wouldn't have
committed murder.
Get out clause.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. But so, and the first ever death by boat, actually, in Rex Factor until Maid of Norway.
Yeah.
Why didn't they just blind him?
Well, I guess Athelstan.
They had a boat. Thought, I've got an idea. This will be fun.
Technically, we're not killing him. Yeah. He does have a boat. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, so that's two of his brothers that are quite conveniently meeting with unfortunate ends.
Yeah, this is looking good.
He may have had an illegitimate daughter.
All right.
But he is said to have remained celibate. Because you asked about the succession. Because there was this dispute about all these other sons, to try and deal with that and the other half-brothers from a third marriage of his father's,
right,
quite a lot of marriages for Edmund the Elder. He's sort of prototype Henry VIII. Athelstan agrees that he won't marry and he won't have any children. So when he dies, it will definitely go to his next half-brother, Edmund. So it's a way of seeing off any family conflict. Athelstan doesn't marry. The brother will take the throne after him. Everybody's happy.
Apart from Athelstan.
Apart from Athelstan. And apart from you, obviously.
Yeah, that's hopeless.
So we've got both kings actually taking up celibacy.
Yeah, that's really bad. They weren't thinking about their sandal score at all.
They really weren't. Another thing, perhaps, for Athelstan, as you said, he never marries.
Mm.
And after his sisters marries, he does keep quite a sort of a young male court.
Oh, hello.
Fostering speaking. Sons from across Europe.
Yes.
All coming, was all he? The courts and all the poets. Mm,
that's a ding. So, but at the time, that would have been outrageous, or was there an element of sort of Greek tolerance?
Well, it's an age of Germanic male heroic culture, if you think of Beowulf and that sort of thing, all these great rulers all around the fire. So actually, perhaps they wouldn't have seen it as being
so he's odd doing,
in any way.
Oh, they wouldn't have seen it as odd?
No, they just thought, ah, we're all great heroes slapping each other's backs and...
Okay. Well, it is up there registered as a potential scandal.
But yeah, so they both really seem to have avoided time in the bedroom.
They did, but at least...
They locked that door.
They did, yeah. And their chastity belt was throw away the key job.
Yeah.
But at least Athelstan had some... is it fratricide, murder of brothers?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Double fratricide, potentially.
Ooh.
At least one.
Yeah. And potentially illegitimate daughter?
Though Alfred potentially had an illegitimate son as well.
So. But at least he had the murders. So he's winning on this front.
Bit of murder.
Mm,
good great. Enough.
Good.
Next one.
Subjectivity.
Well, this is where both of them are going to do rather better.
Yeah.
Particularly Alfred. The challenge for Alfred was immense. The Viking raids and conquest of the previous decade had done terrible damage all across England. Fields were untended, trade was ruined, town living had basically been completely abandoned. So people weren't, I suppose this is for you, they were in their mud huts and hiding away.
Miserable.
Well, it was miserable. That's what Alfred had to deal with. Law and order barely exists. Literacy is almost completely gone. Apparently even the monks who are meant to be writing everything down, quite a few of them, didn't really
just stuck with
write
the pictures.
Very well.
They were good at that, weren't they?
Well, apparently, genuinely, for historians, some of those documents from that time, it's actually quite hard to read because the spelling and the grammar is just all over the place.
Yeah. Oh, so that's why it was Alfred who went and got the monks.
Yeah, Alfred was like, right, we need to do some education. Mm. And of course, the Vikings are actually still there and are still a presence.
Mm. Yeah, not good.
So initially, what Alfred had to do, of course, was win the Battle of Edington and save the potential for an England to exist, but then he's got to build it.
Mm-hmm.
And he is the one that has a vision of creating this kingdom of all the English peoples. He sees beyond the regional identities that we'd had before and thinks, actually, no, we're all one people. This can all be one country.
Right. And to help achieve that, this was the reason for the Burrs and the Chronicles, which gives him an edge because he wrote it all down.
Exactly. So the Burrs are not just effective as a military defence tactic, but it's actually the reinvigoration of urban living again because they are fortified market towns. Alfred designs a lot of these. Actually, in some of the places that he starts, you can still see the town layout in certain places that was actually Alfred's design. It encourages people back in, so we've got community living again. This helps create a sense of identity.
Yeah.
So they're not just private castles, if you will, but they are actually towns that people are living in and trading in.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty good.
It's very good. And of course, that means that with trade, the royal coffers are restored. There's money flowing around again.
Yeah. Okay. So, and I suppose the thing to remember at all times with this is that it's from a point of him sitting in a swamp burning cakes.
Exactly.
Is impressive.
And that's what he's done.
Yeah.
And a chief example of this is that London basically is refounded. The Roman settlement Londinium had been abandoned and the Vikings controlled what was called Ludenwick with Mercian puppet rulers.
Right.
So in 886, Alfred retakes the city and refounds it and forces all of the Saxons to move back into the wall city.
Forces them to move back.
So, oi, in there.
Yeah, where you're nice and safe.
Yeah.
Okay, and using some of the old walls and stuff.
Yeah, so there's a new street plan from Cheapside to the Thames, which again, the layout can still be seen. But Alfred is really the second founder of the city of London.
Mm, yeah, it's looking good, isn't it?
Mm.
Wow.
which maybe isn't quite as popular in Manchester as it would be in London.
Yeah, we should have done this in London, shouldn't we?
You mentioned the fact that he sets up some of the chronicles and stuff for the evidence that we have. So the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle is started in Alfred's reign. And this is a chronicle of all of the nation's affairs and in English. So it's writing down the history of what went before and then chronicling all the events subsequently after that. Right. And it's actually in English, which is unusual for the time, because most of the other courts, like the French, the Franks, it would be in Latin.
Mm.
But for Alfred, he wants things in English so that people can actually understand it.
Right, so that carries on after his reign, and then...
It does, it goes up to 1154, so it actually continues even after the Norman conquest.
Wow. But Asser was his personal biographer.
Right, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So that Athelstan really should have thought of that.
Yeah.
Was Asser still alive, or and just didn't?
No.
Oh, okay, right. Oh, yeah, grandson. Got it, not son. Yep.
So that's all good. Mm-hmm. But it's also really education for Alfred. He wants all officials and clerics to become literate, or they face losing their position, which would sound like a fairly basic job requirement now. But at the time, as we said, a lot of people weren't literate, so he demanded that they either were or they learn.
So they couldn't even read the Bible?
Well, yes, exactly. And also, if Alfred's sending orders off the country, if people can't read, then
it's pointless.
You're not going to be able to control what's going on.
Yeah, it's like the most elaborate game of Pictionary ever. What does he want me to do? Do it all in pictures. That could lead to some really quite awkward scenarios.
He has scholars translating ancient works into English, so mainly Latin. So these are things which are considered to be important for people to know. So either about things about the Bible or philosophy, useful philosophical texts. And as you said, it's not just that he gets people to do it, he actually does it himself, so he has to learn Latin so that he can then translate it into English.
Yeah, but
I mean, this is after he's defeated the Vikings in battle.
He needs a hobby.
He's built all of these towns and he's now doing this.
Yeah, no, that's great. I just can't help but think that it's not a good use of his time. Like, he should be getting other people to do it, but it's still impressive, the idea, and I suppose it's of interest that he did it. But the fact that it's going on at all is great. Pretty good.
And he's quite practical as well. So if you, I think, is it the Ashmolean or is it in the British Museum, the Alfred jewel?
Which is this really
sort of beautiful object, which apparently was a pointer. So it was to help all of the priests and the bishops when they're going through their sermons, and they presumably couldn't read that well.
Yeah,
so they've
follow
got
the
this
line.
Lovely object, and then you just follow the line along, and that's how they know where they are.
That's what the Detectorist jewel is based on, isn't it?
Yeah. And as I said, he's a philosopher king. It's not just that he translates word for word and that's it. He actually does prefaces and he reinterprets it to sort of form his own opinions. So he's actually giving instruction and his own views on kingship, on justice, on life.
Yeah, be very interesting to read. But, it's just such a shame that Athelstan didn't have the foresight to do the same.
And Alfred is doing this basically in the last 10 years of his life, when he's gone through all of that trouble and strife, and he's doing this for the benefit of the country.
Yeah, it is very good, isn't it? There's no getting around it.
So he actually says in one of his prefaces, "It has always been my wish to live honourably and after my death to leave to those who come after me my memory in good works."
He's very, very aware of his legacy, isn't he? The fact that he's got Asser recording everything, and everything is about the future, which hasn't done well for Scandal, but is scoring him really well on this.
And even if you can, you can say that actually, we said before, we know he's good because he tells us that we're good. But in a way, it's quite impressive the fact that he is thinking about legacy. He is thinking about people in the future and looking back on it. He's not just short term. He's not just rushing around, stabby, 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 and then go
putting
home again.
Fires, just drinking a lot. Yeah.
Actually building a future.
It is good. It is good. I take it back.
Well, Athelstan isn't too bad either, though. He's got to rule a much larger territory than Alfred, and as such, that's a bigger job. So he takes a very national approach. He has his own secretariat with control over lawmaking and bureaucracy, regulates the coinage so that it's uniform across the country, and restricts where you can actually have mints.
Yeah, clever.
To make the coins. He bans the buying and selling of major goods outside town. So again, that's promoting urban growth.
And they taxes.
Taxes.
Yeah, very good. But that's all actually down to Alfred, isn't it?
Being initially, yeah. At all. He created the towns and then Athelstan's taking them to another level.
Yeah.
He really focuses a lot on tackling thievery and law and order. So he introduces prison as a penalty. pretty much for the first time for the Saxons. He changes the law so that no one under 15 could be executed.
Oh,
he thought
man.
It was a bit cruel to hear of 12-year-olds being killed for fairly minor offences.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, 15's fine, obviously, but 12 was just far too young. And the ordinance on charities required crown-owned manors to feed the poor and free one penal slave annually, and there was a fine if they didn't do it.
Wow. Just for, like, to show leniency at this.
Being good Christians.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Except for the fact that, obviously, they've got other slaves that aren't being freed, but still,
you know.
One's better than none.
Exactly.
He's renowned as a religious benefactor and revered as a pious king across Europe.
Right.
This is where Ali's interest starts to wane slightly.
Sometimes when we do this, I say, I'm going to get a cup of tea. And we'll go off and refill the mug.
He bestows numerous gifts, relics and books to St. Cuthbert up in Durham, and he cultivates the saints as well. So as well as a religious aspect, it's also quite useful for promoting national identity.
Yeah.
So he takes regional saints and really promotes them as being English saints. So St. Cuthbert up in Durham is one of the chief examples.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fantastic.
So it's helping to bind the country together with the same figures. And he encourages churchmen across Britain and across Europe to come to his court. So he wants the very best of the best to be with him.
Mm.
And of course, he gives us one of the most important church figures that there will be in the Anglo-Saxon world, a lovely young chap from Glastonbury, Dunstan.
What? Why?
Dunstan comes to Athelstan's court. Athelstan is the first man to introduce us to the joy of Dunstan.
Oh my God. I had no idea. This is now really difficult. But so he sees that Dunstan is great, and brings him in.
Yeah.
Oh dear! Oh dear! Oh dear! Oh dear! Oh dear! It's not looking at all good now.
For anyone not familiar with Dunstan, he's this incredible bishop that basically rules. Well, he doesn't rule. Well, he effectively rules at certain points, but he's a chief figure in government and church for about 7 different reigns because the Saxons are very short-lived. So it's Athelstan's the first one, and he's a key figure in setting up later on quite a lot of the things that happen in the country. So actually the coronation ceremony we still have today is actually based largely on Dunstan's original design for Edgar the Peaceable. But Ali got a bit sick of him in the podcast because he just kept on coming up. He was introduced to certain kings and interrupted Ménage Artois.
It was just getting good.
The fun sponge you described him as.
He is a fun sponge. He turns up and says, no, I'll take all that fun away. Thank you very much. Awful man.
Well, and this is where it all starts.
Right, great.
Should we leave Dunstan?
Yeah, if we may.
Okay. William Tyndale in the Tudor period claimed that Athelstan had commissioned an English translation of the Bible.
Oh, that...
Which is following on from what Alfred does, of course, translating everything into the vernacular.
But James the First gets the credit for it years later.
Well, he does the definitive one. It had been done in the reign of Henry VIII as well. But that's quite impressive. It's an awfully long time ago.
Yeah, brilliant.
That's been done. He's the first Saxon king that would have been literate as a child, and he used to give books as gifts to people, had lots of poems written and performed at his court. Some historians have speculated that Beowulf may even have been commissioned for Athelstan. We still don't actually know when it was, so it might have been earlier, might have been later, but it certainly is part of that world that would have been familiar to Athelstan.
Brilliant.
And his court. And it is a magnificent court. We've got ambassadors, clerics, poets, everybody flocking to him. He was given lots of fun gifts, the Holy Lance and the Sword of Constantine.
Right. Okay. There's a lot of those kicking around, isn't there?
Everyone wants those in their collection. He used to hold these national assemblies, attendance by all the rulers across Britain, which, as well as just being useful in terms of diplomacy, it must have been an amazing spectacle.
Yeah.
All of these kings, presumably all of their finery.
Wow.
Great banquets and pageantry.
It'd be fantastic. And then a navy as well on top of that.
Yeah. So it is taking it on quite away from what Alfred would have experienced. Under Alfred, you have a sense of much more hard work and struggling through, whereas under Athelstan, you're getting a bit more of a sort of almost medieval pomp.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a court now, rather than sort of struggling from one battle to the next and getting through.
Mm. Athelstan also takes kingship onto another level. He's the first English king to be consecrated with holy oil and to wear a crown.
Oh, Rex, fact. First one to wear a crown.
And he's the first English king to be portrayed in art as well. It's not a great image. That's why I didn't use that to describe what he looks like. But he's shown presenting a Bible to Saint Cuthbert.
So, not they weren't around at the same time, right?
No, they weren't. But obviously, Saint Cuthbert exists in a holy realm, and Athelstan was there. In reality, Athelstan went to the grave and deposited the books just in the grave.
Right. Good.
But still, that's interesting. Yeah, it's a lot of firsts.
Can we go back to the crown?
Yes.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. Why was this something that was adopted from Europe because he had all this influence?
Yeah, I guess the influence of Charlemagne and all those sorts of people.
Of course. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
When he dies, the Annals of Ulster described him as a pillar of dignity in the Western world. Hmm. And William of Malmesbury, writing 150 years later, said, "The firm opinion is still current among the English that no one more just or learned administered the state. His years, though few, were full of glory."
Mm, brilliant. Mm. What was the rather backhanded compliment that he got at the start? Was it Athelstan that got that?
Alfred about ruling over all of the English except for that bit.
Yeah, whereas this guy... Wow.
Mm. Now, we don't have a biography for Athelstan, but it's possible that William of Malmesbury had access to one and it might have subsequently been lost.
Because he's referencing something?
Yeah.
Okay.
But William of Malmesbury was a bit biased because he's of Malmesbury. That's where Athelstan is based. So although we don't have an Asser, we do have a Malmesbury, who's a bit biased. And as you mentioned earlier, the Cornish and various other people in England and York might not have actually enjoyed being conquered.
Yeah.
So whether we count that as a negative because they didn't want to be conquered or positive because we think, well, it's all England and...
Yeah, we're looking at it just like it was all inevitably building to this.
Mm. Mm. But both of them have done a lot of good work there. There's some good just rule. We should have said subjectivity means would you want to be a subject to that king?
Busy, busy bees.
Mm.
Alfred
scored best here, 17 out of 20 for Alfred versus 12.5 for Athelstan.
Oh, wow.
Well, I mean, Alfred, you've got him translating things into English. He's setting up towns, refounds the city of London.
But if it is the actual period of his reign...
Mm.
There's a lot of time during Alfred where it's not nice.
It's very grim, difficult time.
And then all the time in Athelstan's reign, maybe thanks to Alfred, brilliant.
But a lot of that is set up by Alfred. You've got all of these people that can read and write for the first time. Well, not first time, but after they lost the ability to do so. You've got all these lovely towns that Alfred's designed. You can understand things because Alfred's translated them for you.
Oh, that's tricky. Like,
and it's a real sense, which you don't always get with the kings and queens of England, or indeed of Scotland, a real sense that he has a genuine sort of sense of purpose to do good for the people.
Yeah, he's looking to the future a lot.
Yeah. I think you gave, and this was before you decided you didn't like him anymore, but you said it was a bit like an old man planting a tree that he will never see grow. And that's a good thing for a country when you've got that sort of thing happening.
I agree with myself. But I think I'd prefer to be, and I still think I prefer to be a subject under Athelstan because of all the pomp and everything and the security, I'd feel. It was all a bit too recent with Alfred and they're still just over the border there. I can't believe that we scored them so differently, but again, that was at the start of the show and everything.
That was funny. It was like when we did Robert the Bruce earlier on, and actually it was, at the time, an awful period to be a subject.
Yeah.
Because there's all this war going on, but equally you've got such a huge legacy in re-establishing the country's independence, the Declaration of Arbroath, that was a real powerful piece of rhetoric. So sometimes the subjectivity might not be great right there in the short term, but the legacy in history is pretty amazing.
I can't put anything between them here. It's a score draw for me.
Mm. Not what we said at the time, though.
No. That is often the case, though. George the Fourth? Was it George the Fourth that we recorded the next day because your laptop broke down and we ended up giving him a different score? Or rather, I did.
George the Fifth was the one where we recorded it and then we had to do it all again and you actually gave him the Rex Factor on day two, but not on day one.
I was in a better mood. Lucky George. Longevity.
So this is how long they ruled for. So no debate here, it's a factual one.
Yep.
Alfred was king from 871 to 899, so 28 and a half years.
Yeah.
Athelstan, 924 to 939, just 15 years.
Well, I know this isn't subjective at all, but how much was achieved in much shorter time? pretty good.
Or alternatively, Alfred has got perhaps much more peril than Athelstan. You think Alfred's at a time of the Vikings. The kings that used to resist the Vikings could be blood-eagled or filled full of arrows. It's an incredibly dangerous and difficult time. Mm. And Alfred manages nearly 30 years.
Yeah, maybe he had more to do in a longer period. It could be a draw again then. He did an awful lot.
Well, I mean, it's not because Alfred was king. 28 and a half years, and Athelstan was king for 15 years, so it's...
Sounds pretty equal. Dynasty, not the programme.
Well, let's see if this one is similarly equal. Alfred has 5 legitimate surviving children.
But he made a meal of it, didn't he?
Still did it.
Yeah, all right, yeah.
Athelstan, Mr. Chaste Athelstan, 0 surviving children.
That's no good.
Mm.
That's the worst, in fact.
Indeed. So we can say that Alfred the Great is the 34th great-grandfather of Queen Elizabeth II.
Rex fact.
There's a direct line from Alfred down to the Queen.
Wow. Okay.
Not for Athelstan, though.
No.
Takes a bit of a detour.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't have any surviving legitimate children.
But he does... it doesn't matter.
0.
It's dynasty, isn't it? Yeah.
5 for Alfred, 0 for Athelstan.
Okay.
You're going to call that one...
He's pretty even again, I'd say.
Yeah, well.
5 in it.
So in terms of total scores, Alfred got 55.35 and Athelstan got 47. And we did, of course, also agree, you agreed, that Alfred was undermarked for battliness.
Oh.
So if we could stick a few more points onto Alfred's reign, then, you know, he's looking pretty good there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's funny that that's far more... I thought they'd be much more even again.
Well, the longevity in dynasty hurts Athelstan, obviously.
Yeah, he died too soon. I've said this many times, just don't die. I mean, if he would have... If he'd have lived as long as Alfred, how many more points would that have given him? Would he have been more equal then?
It's been a few more years. He's still been behind. Mm. If he lived for another 5 years and just gone back on his agreement, married, and then just really had a lot of children,
yeah,
then that would have... boosted his score substantially.
Bit, yeah, like what was that about? I mean, you've told us. but still, he wasn't thinking about it.
So how are you looking at them at the moment? Are you inspired perhaps now by Alfred and all the achievements, all he does for the country, saving it from the Vikings, creating a sense of England, re-educating the population? Or do you just want the Emperor of Britain? Do you want the Edward I style thing of just going and kicking the Scots and the Welsh?
Yeah. I do. I can't shake it. I really... I like Alfred a lot more than I did an hour ago.
Mm.
But... And I actually thought... Maybe I was getting confused between the two. I actually thought that...
That is definitely possible.
That Athelstan was a lot more... Had a lot more sexy scandal than Alfred. Yeah. But, you know, there's all that... The idea of an empire... Of Great Britain, wow. Mm. I just think that Battle of Brunanburh, the coming together of all of those kings, is if we had an Asser equivalent, would be seen as much greater than setting up that potential. It was starting from rock bottom and getting a long way, but Athelstan mixed the cake, baked it, and put the cherry on top. Rather than getting the ingredients together.
And just burning them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, I tried to put it in terms that I thought you might prefer a little bit more. If we think about it as a parallel for the Second World War.
I love it already.
1940, we've got Wessex all alone. The Vikings swarming everywhere.
Yeah.
Athelney, we've got this retreat. They're almost completely defeated. He manages to escape, but he's going to have to regroup.
Yeah.
Dunkirk.
Yeah.
And then we have all of the troops, one all or nothing effort, the big attack that if it all goes wrong, that could be your last chance. He has his D-Day at Edington.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't just stop there. He goes on, rebuilds the country, all of the education, the towns, the, you know, basically the NHS equivalent, Labour 1945. He wins the war. He also wins the peace.
Yeah. but he also goes toe-to-toe with the Soviets in Germany and creates a Watling Street, doesn't he? And then we know how that turned out. Not good for poor old Eastern Europeans.
Yeah, we're going to start getting quite complex metaphors now. Yeah.
Now, not to mix a metaphor further, I think that everyone will agree that Athelstan wins. I think your team, Alfred.
Oh. Yeah.
But it's not up to us.
It isn't up to us. It is up to you, the audience. You've got to decide who you think truly deserves to be known as the Great. Is it Alfred the Great? Only great in English history. Must be a reason for that. Or do you think that Athelstan deserves to get more credit?
I called him Alfred the Mediocre, didn't I?
You did.
Why didn't I bring that up?
Because clearly the thought of describing him in such a way would have been ridiculous to you.
Well, I think that he was called great because, this is desperate, isn't it? Because he had his mate Asser writing it all up and he wrote the title on the front page. Athelstan surely should have been called the Great as well. But it's not, anyway.
It's all up to you. So you should have cards. On one side is red. On one side is green, if you can see it with the lights turned down low.
We'll record this, so if we have to count them.
Yeah. What we'd like you to do is, if you want Alfred to win, point the red side towards us. So Alfred.
Very good. Love it.
And if you want Athelstan to win, then point the green towards us. I can't think of a way to make Athelstan sound like green. So it's red towards us for Alfred, green towards us for Athelstan. 3, 2, 1.
Oh dear. Hang on.
Could we possibly have the light back on?
I can't see
the colours. It looks quite close.
It does.
We've had quite a few.
Oh no, the other one? That's oh god.
Oh, it was on the side.
Okay, well
I can see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. I think that Alfred's just nudged that one.
You did the count. 1, 2, 3, 4. I can't actually see the back ones. They're just black. Good idea.
Or if you're holding up a green, can you put it down for the moment so we can just see the reds?
Okay, so.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. Have I done the 1, 2, 3?
Very important.
Yeah, 17. Okay, red's down, green up.
Oh, you clever chap, yeah.
1, 2.
Let's see what you're doing now.
4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16.
Oh! Oh, damn. Hang on. Oh, yeah. No, I thought we could vote, but then we'd split the vote. Yeah. Yeah. Damn.
In which case, Alfred the Great has won by one vote.
What have you done? Well done.
Although I think it would be fair to say that Alfred the Great, but I think Athelstan probably deserves something as well.
Certainly. The Great as well. They can share that. Well, that's not the end, though, because now we've got half an hour or so, or however long you want to ask us questions. So, go on.
Do you want me to ask a question?
Yes.
How are you feeling about that, Ali? A bit disappointed?
Ah, disappointed.
Well, anyway, that's Ali's question. Yeah, so if you've got any questions you want to ask, it can be about Alfred and Athelstan, it can be about either of our first two series, our next series, the animated show, other history, what we've had for breakfast today, anything at all. Very happy to answer.
Actually, the animated show, we've got one of the animators in tonight, haven't we?
Do we?
Oh. Yes, we do. Mike from Tin Mouse, who actually you heard do our intro for us.
Yeah.
Thanks,
Mike. So if anybody has seen our animated show on Rich the Third, that was the work of Tin Mouse Animation. Mike is here today. I think he did an absolutely brilliant job designing all of the characters and all of the artwork and stuff that we did during the campaign. The Jurassic Park car park ting. King t-shirt. Brilliant. So great to have Mike here today. But yes, any any questions, anybody? Yes, I can see a hand in the darkness.
What's the Totalis Rankium guys like?
What are the Totalis Rankium guys like? Ask us a question about a rival podcast. So Tertullus Rankium are, we met them at Oxford. Well, you've met Rob a few times before, haven't you?
Birmingham, yeah.
No, they're very, very nice. They review the Roman emperors and also started doing the American presidents in a format quite similar to Rex Factor. And Rob actually does all of our branding as well. So if you see the monarchs with the headphones and our episode images, and Rob does all of those for us, which is really, really helpful. Yeah, they were really nice. Lovely time at Oxford, didn't we?
Lovely
nice
place. Drinks. Yeah. First time we met Jamie at Oxford, though.
Mm.
Yeah, he's great. Yeah. They're great. Listen to Tertullus Rankium. They're really good. Yeah. Any other questions?
Ooh,
oh, wow.
Three. Okay.
The right of France.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, so our next series, we're going to be doing the Queen and Prince Consorts of England. So those are basically the people who are married to the monarchs. And yeah, there are a lot, because we've been thinking about it quite a bit now. It's coming soon. And yeah, what who are you particularly looking forward to?
I mean, obviously, Eleanor of Aquitaine.
Yeah.
That's a bit like saying Robert the Bruce with the Scottish series, though, isn't it? But Margaret Bonjou, I think. Because I've just been listening to a great audiobook, which... You know, I can't believe that, you know, when she's actually the power behind the throne, that she doesn't get more credit. And we still talk about the king who's just effectively asleep in bed the whole time. I think she's going to be incredible. You saw her jousting, didn't you? That was peculiar in Warwick.
Yeah, I did see her jousting, yes.
I mean, that says a lot about her, that she could actually take this was reenacting the Wars of the Roses through jousting, and they had her as the main character. She'd be great. Yeah.
She is definitely an interesting one, because she's one of those examples where actually the king, Henry VI, was really, really rubbish. But sometimes in those cases, then the queen has to step up and do a lot of the work. So Margaret of Anjou is one case. Isabel of France, who was the queen consort for Edward II, is another one. I'm quite partial to the Tudors, so the six wives of Henry VIII, I think it's going to be one that I'm looking forward to, albeit quite a lot of books to read about them.
You love it, Graham. Philip?
Yeah, so we will end up with Prince Philip, of course. That'll be... I think we'll just have to do the scandal section in just one separate episode.
Yeah, maybe.
Do the rest of it.
Yeah, it's going to be great. Looking forward to it, though.
Is there one particularly you're looking forward to? That's the question.
Taken with Queen Anne's fat, lazy Danish husband when he
was Anne. Prince George.
Yeah.
Yeah, because Charles II said of him, "I've tried him drunk, I've tried him sober, and there's nothing in him."
Oh, Charles, I miss you. Yeah.
So there are a couple of other hands up there. One at the back went up just more quickly than the one at the front. So person at the back, hi there.
I don't think you called it in the episode, if I remember rightly. What do you think Elizabeth II got the
Rex Factor? Do we think Elizabeth II? Yeah, so when we did Elizabeth II, we decided that because she was still current, we couldn't, it wouldn't be fair to decide, because sometimes you learn things, you know, 30 years later or something that might swing you one way more than the other way. What do you reckon? Oh, if you had to call it right today?
You informed me recently that we did score her.
We gave her scores, but we just didn't give her... We didn't
decide
make her eligible for the Rex Factor.
What was her score? Can you remember?
I can't remember. It was a decent score.
Yeah. I think it'd be really hard not to, because... looking at how she dealt with the end of empire and keeping it all together in a period of such change is impressive, and to still have a lot of support, it's difficult, because I think she does, because she's the only monarch everyone here has known. Well, nearly, I don't know. sorry, Dad.
Yeah, she is the queen.
The queen, yeah.
She definitely really has a...
Tricky. I'm trying not to be biased, which is not something I'm used to doing in retrospect. Yeah, I'd say yeah.
It's interesting, because there are certain periods in her reign where maybe you would have said no to that question, like certainly 80s and certainly a spell in the 90s, where she maybe was seen as being a bit boring, a bit out of touch. And then obviously there was the point when Diana died, and there was a brief spell where it really, really looked a bit dodgy for the monarchy. But we're now in a position where, you know, even Republic have basically had to say that until the Queen dies, we're just not even going to really try too much, because everyone just accepts that she's done a good job.
Yeah.
Even if you don't think there should be a monarchy, people seem to accept that the Queen has done the job very, very well. So that suggests that potentially she will, but it is hard to know what we will, what people in the future will think looking back, and whether they'll think that as well, or whether they'll, I guess, be like Ali with Queen Victoria and just get a bit tired of hearing the same name all the time.
Yeah, true. I mean, and also she benefited from the fact that she became Queen quite so young, unlike Charles, who's had his whole life to make lots of mistakes in the public eye and not, you know, think, oh, I've got to be king, I must act, you know, in the way that Elizabeth has been so composed in public. So maybe we'll think that she actually set up the monarchy to fail by not giving it over to Charles quicker. It's those sort of questions that we just don't know. But right now, yes. Have you given your opinion? I feel like I've given one, but I'm not sure if you have.
I'm sure that was pretty definitive for my kind. Maybe.
Like this.
Maybe. I think there's stuff that we might learn, like about when we had the Commonwealth and South Africa. There's, you know, maybe behind the scenes she was trying to influence things more in a way that we don't yet know about. Things recently, actually, like with Ireland, and when she went over and did that first visit. And
but I thought that was amazing.
Oh, no, it went really well. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. There might be, actually, we'll find some things, because she keeps so much hidden and doesn't give her opinions away, that it's not until she dies and letters are released that we'll really learn what she was...
Yeah, and might learn that achieve, she was even better.
Yeah, but, exactly. Yeah. So possibly. Yes. Yeah, so will we struggle to find information about the consorts? Certainly for the Saxons, it's going to be very difficult, because... Unfortunately, the Wessex Saxons seem to have a bit of a beef about queens. So even though Alfred has got his own biographer, he's got the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle set up, we know a lot about Alfred's reign, and yet we don't actually know very much about his wife. And that's because she wasn't considered to be a queen. They don't write about her extensively. So I think for the Saxons, what I'm going to try to do is to take whatever we do know, I'll put out there, but otherwise we might look at aspects of their reign. So for Elswith, who's Alfred's wife, we'll look at why it is that the Wessex chroniclers don't write about queens. Some of them go on to be saints, which is quite an interesting career path for queens to take.
Well, they had nothing to do with Athelstan, did they? I mean,
yeah. Else? So where there's not much information, we'll try to tell maybe a bit more of a general story about royal women in the period. But I think once you get to the Normans, I think it's quite well recorded, and they do have quite prominent roles at court and in the nation's affairs. So I think we'll get to a point where there's definitely enough information. For the Saxons, we might have to be a bit more inventive.
Hashtag remember Ith.
Hello. Yes.
Yep.
Best in there.
Last kingdom or Vikings?
Ooh.
Vikings.
Yeah. What Vikings has done, so these are two TV programs for anyone that's not watched them. What Vikings have done really well is that it's managed to pretty much get rid of all of the main characters and then carry on going, and it still be interesting, which I think is quite impressive. Mm. The thing which annoys me about Vikings is that initially I was like, this is really good because a lot of what we know is in sagas, so it's all exaggerated anyway, so you don't know whether things did or didn't happen. But then once they started doing the Saxon stuff, and then we've got Alfred the Great is actually the illegitimate son of a Saxon monk called Athelstan, and his father and grandfather are seemingly fine about this because this quite dull monk was so amazing that...
I thought you were describing Alfred there. He just comes across as a very dull monk. I didn't like it because I couldn't empathise with any of the characters. I found...
Is this Last Kingdom you talk about?
Yeah. I found...
Because Alfred is now in Vikings.
Oh, I haven't caught up that far.
Because the other thing with Vikings is... The other thing with Vikings is that it's it takes place over seemingly quite a long period of time, because they start off at Lindisfarne in 793 and we're now at Alfred, who's sort of around in the 50s or 60s.
Yeah.
So they've got some quite long-lived Vikings.
And in Last Kingdom, I can't even get behind the protagonist. He's just really annoying. But I still watch them, though, because it's just really fun.
I'm not quite sure why you find both of them annoying, because you've got Alfred being really pious, and then you've got Uhtred being really, oh, let's just go and fight a battle.
Because he can't do anything without saying Uhtred Uhtredson. Every time. I'm putting on Uhtred Uhtredson's coat and then I'm going to go and be Uhtred Uhtredson. We get it. Just wear a badge. Rubbish.
But I like both. Vikings has got a better theme tune, I think.
I can't remember how it goes.
I'm not going to see it.
Any other questions?
What would your answer be? Vikings or...
Vikings by Mars. Yeah, quite right.
Yes.
You watch Norseman?
Have we watched Norseman? This is the comedy. Yes.
I really want to.
It's really good.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like Vikings meets Monty Python. And yeah, it's really good. It's really dry and deadpan.
Yeah.
And yeah, I really like it. There's a couple of series on Netflix. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I really like Norseman.
It's on my watch list. A quick question. You've been playing a couple of pranks on me in this series. Is this microphone one of them? Because I seem to be getting lower and lower to talk to you. I really apologise if it's distracting, but it's really distracting here too. So I'll just sit like this. Yes, it's on the watch list.
Yes, I'm in the middle.
Of the two series that you've done, who are your personal favourite, either more or less sort of characters, except Edward.
Not Edward the First, Ali.
Well, that's three references, though. That's pretty. Thank you.
So, our personal favourites of monarchs or characters from the first couple of series of Rex Factor. I mean, I'm guessing if you can't say Edward the First, you're going to say Dunstan.
No, I will say least favourite, definitely Dunstan by such a wide margin. I can't even think of anyone else. Charles II, our friend Pineapple Head, though also honourable mention to the Penguin.
So that's William IV, Pineapple Head, William III, the Penguin. In terms of non-royals, I think William the Marshal is probably my favourite one. So he was this amazing knight that served under Henry II, Henry II's younger son, who was known as the Young King, Richard the Lionheart, John, and then he saves the country from a French invasion under the young Henry III, reinstates Magna Carta. It's actually under William, really, that Magna Carta properly takes off, rather than under John, because John reneged on it as soon as he'd agreed to it. And William the Marshal, at sort of 70 years old, charging into battle at Lincoln, saving the country, he was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
Loved a bit of William the Marshal.
And Manny! Definitely. Love Manny.
Knight that his own battle cry was to shout his own name. That's what more can you want?
Any other questions? No.
Okay.
Well, but as we said at the start, we're selling t-shirts at the back, but please just come and have a chat. We're going to hang around and have a drink. So if you want to come and say hello, we'd love to meet as many of you as possible. So please don't disappear off unless you have a train to catch, we understand. Thanks very much for coming and for donating to the Kickstarter if you did, and just for listening, because it's so great to get the feedback that we actually aren't just two little fellas from Essex chatting into a microphone, but there are people out there who listen. So thank you very much.
And thank you so much for coming. It's been really, really great. Thank you very much.
Cheers.